Now it gives me great pleasure to be able to introduce Ian Hislop and Charlie Higson for what will be a fascinating and entertaining discussion on Ian's new play, Spike, delving into the mind of one of Britain's most influential but often overlooked comic geniuses, Spike Milligan. Ian needs very little introduction to the generations of us who have enjoyed his sharp wit on Have I Got News For You. He has been an editor of Private Eye since 1986 and is an award-winning journalist, broadcaster and writer. He has also been a less successful legal expert on defamation and privacy laws. Ian is joined by Charlie Higson, a festival regular, an actor, comedian and writer who has written a series of novels on the young James Bond at school, amongst many others. Please join me in giving them a warm welcome to the festival.
Thank you.
We have to rather undignified clamber onto our high chairs so that you can see us, and I'll turn to face you. It's fabulous to be here and to talk to Ian. I don't know quite how I got my name on the programme. I'm doing very little to this other than ask the questions which Ian has very kindly emailed to me. So.
You don't want to leave anything to chance.
No. So I'm really just a prompt. In fact, I can prod you with that. So yes. Let's get right to it now.
Yes.
The first question you sent me. So
can I just say the seminal moment is for me and Spike Milligan was I interviewed him rather like this on BBC Radio on midweek, and in those days it was live. And they had a birthday guest who they gave a bottle of champagne. License fee in those days, well, really ran to something. And I was interviewing Spike. And I opened the champagne, and it went all over my notes, which I'd written in green felt pen. So there was nothing but this sea of green. And I had absolutely no idea where to start. And Spike, who'd been quite grumpy, thought this was the funniest thing that had ever happened. And he started interviewing himself. he totally saved my bacon. And secondly, I thought, that's quite a good way to do it. So that's why I sent the questions to Charlie.
Well, I'll try not to spill my water all over these. So the first question Ian sent me. Ian, what's it like being Britain's cleverest and funniest man?
Well, since this is on the level of breakfast TV, Spike certainly was.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. Was you know, the height of his fame, which was presumably the height of the Goons' popularity, how much of a sort of public figure, a well-known figure, was he? Was he a star?
Yes, and a very reluctant one. Spike was curious in that he wanted to be famous and he wanted people to know who he was, and then he was furious when they did. So, I mean, there's a terrific story of fans coming up to him and Harry Secombe in the early days of the Goons, and they sort of become famous, they become household names, and one of the fans said, oh, you're fantastic. And they're like, oh, you're the guy, whatever. And then they said, oh, tell us a joke, Spike. And he said, no. And the fan said, go on, I mean, you're a comedian, tell us a joke. And Spike said, what do you do? And the bloke said, well, I'm a carpenter. He said, all right, make me a table.
So
he had a curious attitude to fame. But, I mean, the Goons, I mean, this play we wrote, which I really wanted to write about a comedian and write about success and the fun of it, because nearly all plays and all films about comedians are tears of a clown and weren't they miserable and didn't they die alone and aren't their wives awful and that was about it. And I thought it'd be quite novel to write a play about 1953 when Spike Milligan, Peter Sellers and Harry Secombe were at the height of their powers and they were producing a show that millions of people, I mean literally millions and millions of people all over Britain were tuning into on a Sunday afternoon. It was it was a phenomenon. I thought, well, I wonder if drama can accommodate a modicum of happiness. Anyway, you'll see if you ever go to see it. But that was the idea. And this entire festival, I always think, has been, it's that phrase, to try and compensate for the condescension of history. Everything that happened a long time ago seems to be incredibly boring to take a certain view. And people say, the goons, oh, the goons, yes, that was funny voices, wasn't it? And was it Prince Charles liked it, which is more or less the kiss of death for nearly anything. So I thought, well, actually, if you go and listen to the goons and you look at the scripts, these are quite extraordinary. Not only were they sort of surreal and satirical and inventive, they basically redefined how to do comedy in Britain. And they were produced, and again, this is why I think it's interesting to do at a history festival, they were produced just after the Second World War. And I don't mean, you know, a reasonable period. 53, the Goon Show, the war ended in 45. You know, and the BBC execs were already saying to Spike, oh, come on, Spike, the war, it was a long time ago. It was 8 years ago. and they were already unhappy about his obsession with the war. But I'll talk about that anon.
So it started in 53 and roughly ended...
They did bits and pieces. They did bits and pieces and they tried to turn it into television. But it was the golden 50s. And again, why I really wanted to write a play, because I thought Spike was someone who basically needed to rebel against something. And the army was fabulous for him because he spent his entire time complaining about it and being what they called a barrack room lawyer in those days. I mean, he was told initially by one of his officers, he said, lying around playing the trumpet, Milligan, isn't going to win us the war. And Milligan said to him, what about the tuba? he always had that attitude. And essentially, they all got demobbed after the end of the war and tried to go into comedy. And the next institution that was entirely stuffed full of the officer class and people in blazers was the BBC. So Spike and Sellers and Seacombe, who were all came from the ranks, found themselves being told what to do yet again by the same set of people who'd been telling them what to do for 5 years. And part of Spike hated this, and part of it, I think, made him, because it was that having something to push against. And the BBC had an archive of letters, which is why I started getting interested, between Spike and various BBC management types, which were so funny. I thought, we have got to use this stuff. And it was all just hanging around at the BBC. And it's mostly Spike complaining about money. That's nearly all of it. But the other letters are the management's attempts to deal with Spike's complaints and the sheer pomposity of the exchange, which again is very, very recognisable.
But I mean, he in many ways, he was very justified to complain about the money, wasn't he? Because
he was
paid virtually nothing.
Yes. Well, the BBC decided that Peter Sellers was the talent. He got £36. Harry Seacombe was a lovely voice and very reliable. He got £34. Spike, he wrote the whole thing and appeared in it, £18. I mean, they really didn't like Spike. And all comedy writers feel we're underpaid anyway.
How many episodes was he writing a year?
30, 40. I mean, it was an incredible amount and an incredible pressure on him. And Peter Sellers used to say, well, you don't use any of my ideas. And Milligan said, that's because you give them to me after the show's gone out. I mean, there was a huge tension between those two, which, again, was part of, I think, in any comedy, as we all know, working with people and finding it difficult to work with them is part of what drives it. I mean, Spike Milligan did actually attempt to kill Peter Sellers, which is quite extreme. Again, this is a great British comedy incident in that Spike had a lot of sort of mental problems, but he always said that Peter Sellers was not much madder than he was. I mean, Sellers thought that he was Napoleon reborn, and that he'd been at Waterloo, and he communicated through a spirit guide, a Native American. and at one point, he stopped recording because Spike was wearing a green jumper. And everybody had to go along with this, and Spike was furious. People said, God, Spike Milligan, oh, he's nuts. He said, Sellers, he's completely out of lunch. Anyway, Milligan got it into his head that Peter Sellers was pumping music into his flat late at night to stop him writing the scripts. And Sellers always said, God, all I wanted to do was finish the bloody script. But then Spike went round to his flat and said, it's all over, I'm going to kill Peter Sellers. And he grabbed something from Sellers' kitchen and then pointed at him, and Sellers said, that's a potato peeler. at which point, Spike was taken away by the police and the ambulances. But so, Sellers actually said, you never know with these anecdotes afterwards. Sellers said, he said at the time, he said, OK, Spike, what are you going to do? Peel me?
your starting point for this was the joy and the happiness and of making comedy.
Yeah.
Well, it's gone way beyond that quite quickly.
It did, and it gets dark, but it is always incredibly funny. Mm. And Spike turned all of that sort of darkness into comedy. And for me, I think the starting point was I had two ideas after having read a lot of this archive and looking at it, and I thought, well, every single sketch, every single program in The Goons either ends or begins with an enormous explosion. Someone is always blown up at some point. And Spike himself was blown up in 1944 in Monte Cassino in the assault. And that, he always said, was the starting point of his mental problems, because he quite clearly had sort of PTSD. But I couldn't believe, and you can see this in the correspondence, they're saying, Spike, this new episode you've written, does it end with someone being blown up? And he goes, yes, it does. And they said, look, we had that last episode. He said, no, it was a grenade last episode. And I thought, in my most pretentious way, that this was almost like an analysis of the joke. Everything is boom-boom. It's an enormous punchline, woof. And in the play, because I'm a comic writer, I put it into the mouth of a very pretentious critic. It's actually my own idea, but I didn't want to own it. So we have a session with the critics in which everything I think about Spike is mediated through them. But it's basically shell shock on radio. and that is a lot of what The Goons is.
But, it's interesting that you've obviously got the great love and admiration for Spike, but you're my generation, so you can't have been listening as a kid.
No, and I think this is why we've had a two-month run of this play, but part of it is just to explain to audiences who the Goons were and why they're funny, and also just to do their material live in a theatre and watch people laugh. It's not that sort of, oh, yeah, aren't old people funny, laugh. It's, my God, you were writing those jokes then. And it is, for me, it's slightly secondhand. My co-writer, Nick Newman, who comes from a forces family, and you find this with a lot of Goon enthusiasts. His dad was RAF and his grandfather, and a lot of the people, if you look at Eddie Izzard or French and Saunders, a lot of the people who really loved the Goons and went on were played this stuff by their parents. So I felt my appreciation of it was sort of almost more genuine because it was secondhand. I hadn't grown up on it. Nick, my friend, can quote the entire, scripts to backwards.
I remember in the 70s when I was a teenager, they started reprinting the scripts in book form, and that was... my dad had played bits to me, but it was quite hard, without the internet. yep. to actually see or listen to this stuff.
Yeah.
It was different now with the likes of Radio 4 Extra. But yeah, so I came to it probably through the scripts, first of all.
And I think that's a very good way to come to it, because without the scripts and without the voices, you just get the sheer cleverness of it. And I mean, it's just sort of Spike's sort of part of his success as a comic. He would just push the joke well beyond where it should be. I mean, there's one episode where there's a giant oyster, obviously, underwater, and they're on a journey to find it. So they go underneath, and then they knock on the door of the oyster. Knock, knock, knock. Who's there? And a very, very old woman comes out to answer the door. And Spike says, are you Pearl? And she says, no, I'm her mother. And then there's an enormous pause while he waits for the audience to get there, and he says, you're the mother of Pearl? And you just think, that's amazing. And also, I mean, he was a huge influence on the writers of Dad's Army and Monty Python and all these people. And you can just see a lot of these jokes were done very, very early by Spike. I mean, the famous, you know, Dad's Army joke, which is constantly voted the funniest joke of all time with Pike and the German officer. There's a scene in which the police interview Henry and Minnie, the Kruns, and the policeman says, which of you is Henry Krun? And Minnie says, don't tell him, Henry. Spike had done the don't tell him Pike joke 20 years before. And there's so much of that. When you read it through, you just think, this is quite extraordinary.
So was he doing comedy in the war? Was he part of the what was it called? Entertaining the troops?
Yes, he was. He was trying to be funny in the NAFI and playing the trumpet, which he started playing the trumpet, and then he started doing jokes in between. He always said his first joke, he was playing the trumpet, he said, and now for my favourite number, 6. he did that joke for a lot of years. And then they were all basically meeting in a pub called the Grafton Arms in London after the war ended.
Him and
Sellers and a character called Michael Benteen, who was one of the first.
Had he met them during the war or only after?
He and Seacombe, again, the trouble with all of them is as they got older, they became less and less reliable as narrators. If you read any incident from Spike's past, there are a couple of versions of it. One of them in which he met Harry Seacombe during the war, one of them he didn't. But very soon afterwards,
right.
They all got together and they were put together in a group, like a sort of boy band.
Right.
Actually, not very like a boy band. But Harry Seacombe was doing a shaving comic routine in between the strippers at the windmill. He came on and pretended to shave and sang. I mean, music hall probably not at its finest. Michael Benteen was doing similar routines, pretending to be a foreign professor. Spike was writing and trying to get in, writing for other shows. And Sellers was basically an impressionist. He did amazing voices. The BBC management, when they first came in, there's a wonderful description of the four of them. And it goes, Michael Benteen, marvellous. He was at Eton. That was important for light entertainment. Then Peter Sellers, it was, Sellers can imitate anyone. Do you know, he pretended to be a major during the war and went into the VIP tent. Spike, freak. So they were an odd cross-section, and they were all trying to get into comedy. And then Benteen did the first series and then left again.
Did he write on that with
he
Spike?
He did write, but again, the two of them didn't have a similar view of the world. I think Spike's... Spike was once asked, he said, what are you so cross about? Who do you hate? And he said, well, I blame my father, Leo, who was in the British Army and was Irish. And they said, well, that doesn't explain. Who did your father hate? And he said, oh, my father hated everyone who wasn't Irish and everyone who was Irish. Which was sort of Spike's line. It was pretty broad brush.
I mean, Michael Benteen always seemed very, very sort of genial and...
Yes, and he had a more mellow view of the world. And I think that clashed.
Yeah, and you could always see in Spike stuff behind that sort of front of zaniness and that there was something, as you say, darker or more complex going on behind.
And also, I mean, I always think Spike turned it into joyfulness, but there was also always an elbow there. And people say, oh, God, funny voices and they sang songs. And but thank goodness satire came along in the 1960s. Which is entirely wrong. I mean, everybody in the satirical movement, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, were basically trying to be Spike. When Private Eye was set up, Richard Ingrams was writing for Spike. He was trying to do a play. And when I took over as editor, Richard said to me, Spike Milligan will write you letters. Put them in. Doesn't matter if you understand them. just put them in. That was his advice. And they did that lot, all worshipped Spike.
But how much satire is there in the actual Goons?
Oh, I think there's a huge amount. I mean, again, you're coming straight out of the war, and this comes from the archives, but there's a character called Major Bloodnock, and anyone who's a Goons fan will know. And the BBC management said, all the officers in this show are either cowardly or taking bribes. Why is this? And Spike's like, oh, no. And he said, no, in this one, Major Bloodnock is asked, are you running away from the enemy? And he replies, well, it'd be silly to run away from anyone else. and at one point, Bloodnock is surrounded by German troops and he starts singing Deutschland über alles. And again, this is just coming off out the end of a war. And so... it was not only, you know, permeated in that sort of class-based comedy, but it was also, I mean, Spike was brought up for, there was an episode which covered the coronation, and there's quite clearly in it a character who is the Queen, and Peter Sellers is playing the Queen, and they disguised it. She's called the Duchess Boyle de Spudswell. classic... Goon, and you know, they said, look, this is quite clearly the Queen. We can't have you making fun of the Queen. Spike said, no, it's not the Queen. It's the Duchess Boyle de Spudswell, and said, well, why is she opening Parliament? And then, I mean, again, there's a similar argument about Winston Churchill. And, you know, BBC, this is higher BBC management. The producers were marvellous and, you know, sort of essentially... as ever, you know, made the shows. But they said, you have made fun of Winston Churchill and you keep going on about W.C. Churchill. W.C. as though that's funny. and Spike's here, well, it is quite funny, isn't it? And someone said to me, he said, look, Winston Churchill won the war. And Spike's going, well, some of the rest of us were there. And there was a genuine feel with him that he wasn't going to have that sort of reverence. And it is funny when you think now about the sort of slightly misty-eyed view of the Second World War, which was not shared by the people who were there. It was much more real for them and much more nuanced. And so the Goons were endlessly parodying, you know, things like Operation Mincemeat and The Man Who Never Was and... the idea of this fantastically clever and fiendish intelligence operations that fooled the Nazis. You know, I think from where Spike was, there was very little fiendish or clever going on. It was mostly enormous cock-up and buggering through, as he would put it.
So the satirical element is the anti-authoritarian... Absolutely. ..undermining the powers that be.
Yes, and I think that's... It drove Spike mad, but I think that's what got him going. And there is... The BBC's finest 1950s drama production was Big Brother. They put on George Orwell. And they were incredibly proud of it. And so Spike wrote 1984. 1984 was a production. Spike wrote a goon show called 1985, which featured the Big Brother Corporation, in which hopeless proles had to churn out drama and comedy. And I mean, it's incredibly funny. And again, made a lot of those early Spike jokes. He falls in love with a woman from the records department, and she says to him, "I've always loved you from afar." And he says, "Oh, my favourite distance." and it goes on. It goes on in that point until we come to room 101, and Winston Seagoon is going to be tortured for trying to resist Big Brother. And he's fine right up to it. And he said, "Well, we are now going to subject you to your worst fears." And then they play the theme tune of The Archer. At which point he just packs it in and gives up.
Didn't George Orwell base the headquarters of Big Brother on the BBC?
Absolutely. So it was sort of cyclical.
Yeah. And, you know, it's all been redeveloped now, but in the old days at Broadcasting House, honestly, there's endless corridors with weird rooms called things like Room 101.
Yeah.
You could easily see how that would get into your psyche. So why was it called The Goons?
Good question, and one that Spike gave endless answers to. I think it was army slang for people who were stupid. At various points, he said it was something to do with Rangoon, where he'd been brought up, which I don't think was true. And there was a character in an American sitcom called The Goon. But actually, I think it was just from the army. And initially, the head of BBC, Lightent and Variety, said, "Now, the go-on show." And then Spike obviously loved that because this bloke didn't want the show to go on at all. He wanted it to come off. So right from the start, it fooled people. The BBC wanted to call it Crazy People.
But didn't it start as that?
Yes.
Was that not the first series with Benteen or before?
Yes.
That? Right.
But there was a show on in the West End called Crazy People.
Right.
Crazy. Yes, but they were called the Crazy Gang, and the show itself was called Crazy People. No. The Beeb made a huge thing about this. So then they said, "We can't call it Crazy People. We'll call it Young Crazy People." So this is management at its most creative. So it was called that for the first episode, and then it was just incredibly embarrassing. So they said, "All right, you can call it The Goons," and then it took off.
And I mean, at what point during the run of The Goons did Peter Sellers start getting into films and becoming that much more of a star than the others?
Almost from the beginning. He was in short films, and then he started appearing in things like I'm All Right, Jack. Mm. And so there was a sort of deference to Sellers that he was a major star, or going to be a major star. And Harry Secombe, who had this absolutely extraordinary voice. I mean, he really was a very, very good tenor. And those were recognisable talents. Whereas Spike, writing, always difficult to quantify. And he was trouble. And he was always complaining about nearly everything. He was asked, did he have any new ideas for the next series? And he said, "Yes, I do. One, more money. two, more money. Three, do I mention the money?" Which again always goes down very badly.
Yeah, and no, presumably no residuals or any.
No, there was a lot of arguments about repeats and whether they were on in the wrong time of day and whether they should be in the home service. In the 1985 parody, it says, "We're going to send you to the Forbidden Zone." And then the Sellers character said, "What, that's 4 o'clock on a Sunday, is it, on the light service?" Which is, he couldn't resist complaining at every point.
And so your play Is it set just within 1953, or does it cover?
It's set about a year before and the years after, and it's just about the problems of trying to make comedy work, about why it works, and about what are the pressures that get put on people that they still produce this amazing stuff. And part of Spike's problem was that he'd been accused of cowardice in the war, which is when he had shell shock, and he was demoted. They took a stripe off him after Monte Cassino, and there was a character called Major Jenkins who was in charge of Spike, who made his life absolutely miserable, and Spike reacted very, very badly to that, hence all cowardice jokes from then on. The feeling that these people were totally insensitive to what the troops were going through. Jenkins apparently said he thought the best cure for Spike's shell shock would be the sound of gunfire. Again, Spike tells this story as though it would be sort of a negative reaction that would get him going again. I think his reaction to that is amazing. I mean, there's a wonderful sketch with Major Bloodnock, and he calls in his Batman, who was essentially Spike's role, and he said, I want you to take my boots off. And then you hear Spike going, and then he says, and never wear my boots again. it is extraordinary how all those experiences turn into this just fabulous comedy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things everyone knows about Spike, particularly in later years, was how badly he suffered from depression. Yep. Was it depression or was it manic depression?
He said, he was asked, what's the technical name for your condition? And he said, I'm a loony. he was mistrustful of... I think we'd call him bipolar now.
Yeah. How much of that fed into the work, do you think?
I think a great deal. I mean, the others in Seacombe had had shell shock as well. And Harry Seacombe, when you look into their story, he just comes over as the most extraordinarily good bloke. He was fantastically kind. And he covered all Spike's expenses when he was married and fell into debt. He was just an extraordinary friend to him all the way through. And he always said that quite a lot of us had PTSD, but Spike had it worse than most. So he was always incredibly forgiving. And if you look at the any of the interviews they give or any of their publicity, Seacombe is always the one trying to smooth things over, trying to keep the show on the road,
keep the band together.
And essentially he constantly tried to remind them that this is fabulous. We're being paid to do this on a Sunday. Everyone thinks we're marvelous, and we're not in the army anymore. And for him, the whole thing was a bonus. And I think part of the joy of the Goons is listening to Seacombe. I mean, he had a rude letter from management saying, could you try and make it look as though you're not having more fun than the audience? you're saying, well, we were.
Well, I know Peter Sellers always looked back on it as the happiest time in his life. And
yeah.
He just had to turn up and do funny voices and shine, and someone else was doing all the hard work for him.
And he got cross with Spike, but I think he always acknowledged that the quality of the script, in the end, was what everyone would go for. Mm. And he did lots of films where the scripts were terrible, and Seacombe gave up comedy afterwards and just did, Highway and other religious programs on a Sunday. And that's everyone's memory of him. Sorry, it's partly... Even my own memory of Spike was a bit of a grumpy old bloke. And I thought it would be salutary just to remember how good they were at their peak.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of stories of Sellers in later life when he's fabulously rich and fabulously miserable and everything falling apart, that he would ring Spike late at night and say, Spike, can't we just do another Goon show?
Yeah. Well, and I think Sellers tells the story of people said, oh, your voices were absolutely fantastic. And he said, well, Spike used to turn up and just add stuff. He was always adding stuff in the middle where you thought you'd rehearsed it. And he said there was one thing where Spike turned up and in the middle of a sketch about something else, suddenly just said, hello. And Sellers said, well, who are you meant to be? And he said, I'm Husky. He later said it was a sketch about the North Pole. But being Spike, he hadn't told anyone. It was just all going on in his head. But I think the three of them did genuinely have an affection for each other. And that came across. And it was very... I was thinking about the reception of the Goons. It was sort of... Again, it was led by the young. The first people who liked it were the people who were not meant to be listening to it. So it was children. And then you can see this in the letters that come in. The letters come in saying, I told my children this programme is not funny and it's not clever. And then I listened to it and I thought, it is quite funny. and it is quite clever. And then they come in saying, I love this programme. And it's sort of, the BBC always has standards. You know this, writing for comedy. So they start off saying, I don't like this programme because it's getting very low figures. And then you get very high figures, and they go, it's not only the figures that matter. the critics don't like it, and then you get good reviews. And they go, well, you can't rely on the critics. And then they say, what about the audience feedback? Not very good, is it? And then you produce a sack of letters. And then they go, yeah, well, comedy. and then they sack the programme anyway. So the Goons had that entire trajectory. The letters, the fabulous letter from a woman writes to Spike saying how brilliant he is, absolutely terrific, and he ends up, she says, you've changed our lives completely. By the way, my husband is a tax inspector. And Spike writes back and says, thank you for your letter, I owe you. he was unbelievably quick, and you see that. In the recordings and also in the script, but that was part of his thing. And in terms of complaints, I hope it doesn't sound dry, but the essence of his fight to get stuff on was just incredibly funny. He was told at one point, he said, the Goon Show is far too noisy, and he wrote back saying, well, I would stand further away from the radio.
But he did have a love of sound effects, didn't he?
Yes. He was completely obsessed by the sound effects on the Goons. And some of the sound effects ended up getting their own fan club. There was a sound effect for this oyster. He was obsessed by oysters. And there was a character called Fred the Oyster, who had unbelievably disgusting, squelchy sound effects when he opened and came. And this got its own celebrity. People would just turn up and say, where's Fred the Oyster? And can we hear the sound effects? And Spike, he basically changed the BBC sound effects department, which was something, extraordinary place. They had 12 different types of silence on record. And they had hundreds of explosive sound effects, which Spike went through all of them, looking for the loudest one or one he could do. And so he started working with them to create these incredible effects. The one he was incredibly proud of, which was he had some custard, which he put in a sock and hit someone with. And they said, well, that's amazing. What's it meant to be? And he said, it's someone being hit with a sock full of custard. Featured very, very strongly in a lot of scripts.
Do you recreate any of the routines in the play?
Yes, we try and do this, and the sound effects operator becomes a sort of person, a character in their own right, because they did a lot of them live, and they are not only what you can do with recordings, but what you can do live. the one that really had it for me was just an umbrella. And if you do that with it, it sounds like birds being disturbed in a bush. You listen to the goons, it happens quite a lot. People crash into a bush and they go... and he had... there's a musical saw, you know, which is a very old-fashioned thing. You have a violin bow and a saw, and it creates that extraordinary chilling music. When she goes... wonderful stuff. And he's always, you know, Spike's often blowing up balloons and then letting them down at various speeds. At one point, there's this tiny little balloon on stage, and it goes... And he says, what's that? And he says, it's the Hindenburg. We're working on it. So we try and do a bit of that.
And let's just look a bit about what happened to him after the Goons. Because the BBC did still employ him over the years, didn't they? I mean, you know, probably the thing I know him most for was doing the Q series, which... Ooh. Was most extraordinary and very much felt like his own little club, his own little world. And I always felt it was, you know, were the BBC just being kind to him, or did it do well? Or what was the reaction to things like that?
Well, I think the Q series was, it came, and it was essentially, they were always trying to do the Goons on television. And unfortunately for them, Monty Python came along. And basically, and Michael Palin's the first to admit this, he said, we did the Goons on television. And they got, in a sense, superseded. And Spike, he was on his own. And so Seacombe had gone, Sellers had gone, his great producers, Peter Eaton and Dennis Mayne Wilson, these people had all gone. And he was left, I think, rather bereft. And what he turned to, which was absolutely fabulous, was, you know, writing his memoirs, you know, that fantastic series of books, and then Puck of Pook's Hill, which is absolutely fabulous children's book, and then his poetry, and then he developed another life, which essentially was not doing comedy on its own anymore. And I mean, even in the 50s, a gloomy Spike was saying, oh God, my tombstone, it's going to say, he did the Goons, and then he died. And the others in later life said, well, that's not so bad, is it, Spike? You know, most people didn't do the Goons.
Yeah,
and that's what we were trying to say, is that that later Spike... you know the story about his tombstone? Yeah, well, I went and had a look at it, and of course it doesn't say that. Spike always said, I want my grave to say, I told them I was ill. Pretty good joke. They objected, and then there was a wrangle with the church authorities, inevitably. So now it says it, but in Gaelic. So he sort of won. And in the end, you know, he got very cross and took Irish citizenship, and he fell out with a vision of Britain, I think. It is interesting, in his later years, most of the people he spent a lot of time with were his old buddies from the army. And he had a nostalgia for that time and that period that never left him. So, and he liked the royal family, and, you know, despite calling Prince Charles a grovelling little bastard, it's fantastic. If you look at the footage of that on YouTube, you'll see me in the bottom right. Thinking, God, this award ceremony is boring, because I hadn't been given anything. and then suddenly, on came Spike, and he just couldn't resist it. It was live. The Prince of Wales was there. The Prince of Wales says, you're marvellous. And he just goes, you grovelling little bastard. It's just incredibly funny. You know, and some of the great satirists of, you know, of our era have happily taken OBEs and have become... You know, cartoonists who've taken knighthoods, and he didn't do any of that. He was the real deal, right to the end, and conflicted by it. You know, I think he ended up saying the army was the best thing that happened to me, and then people would say, well, people were trying to kill you, Spike, all the time, and he said, yeah, apart from that, he just loved it, And
did he ever come to terms with the goons? Because, you know, he was so tied up with his relationship with the BBC and money and
yes.
his bitterness of what happened, and obviously Peter Sellers going on to become a massive star.
He did. I mean, I did know him in old age, and he became reconciled
right.
to the fact that this wasn't a bad legacy. You know, he had a great success with the Adolf Hitler, My Partner's Downfall, and the Mussolini book, where you can read a lot of the wartime stuff. So, I mean, he had other avenues which had gone. But I think in the end, like anybody who's gone through a period with colleagues, even if you hated them at the time, as you get older, you find, God, at least they get the references. And if I spend time with them, they still know what I'm talking about. So I think he was reconciled. I mean, how are we doing for time?
You got 26 seconds.
I just wanted to read the thing that Harry Secombe said about him, which is the thing I absolutely like. And they were talking about, you know, all the problems, what did you have, what's your memory of the goons? And Harry Secombe said, I just say before I do this quote, that the BBC found out that they were drinking brandy during rehearsals in milk. They sent a letter. Despite saying, you think you're so bloody clever, but actually we know that you're mixing milk and brandy and drinking it in rehearsals. And Spike wrote back saying, really? I thought it was going well. But anyway, Harry Secombe said, and this was his bit, he said, the goons, it was a time for hysteria and brandy, for soaring upwards on the thermal currents of Spike's imagination, for wishing that every day of the week was Sunday, which I thought was a pretty good a bit.
And a good point to end, certainly, our part, and go to questions. Can I just say, you know, were any of you Goon fans of the show in earlier days? And which of you came to Spike Milligan, say, through his books, like the My Partner's Downfall or his poetry and stuff?
Right.
It's interesting because, you know, I mean, he's one of those people who probably is going to be slowly forgotten, isn't he? Because...
Not if I can help it.
Well, it's, you know, Peter Sellers made films and became a star in America, and it seems to be, unless you get that international thing...
Yes.
You don't have that more, bigger legacy, whether you're a band, a comedian, whatever. And Spike was always very much... I'm going to say parochial, but...
I think he was parochial, and you look back and you think, well, nearly every episode contains a reference to the Naffy. You know, who's going to get that? Who outside a quite niche England is going to appreciate this? But then I think there's so much else in there. You know, we don't abandon nearly all texts from 500 years ago because we need the footnotes. I think there's enough, and I think if you... present his stuff in the right way, you can see the genius of it.
And your play is touring from when?
It's touring from the beginning of September, and it's touring for about 12 weeks, and it may go into the West End.
Coming down this way?
I will be down this way. Again, I will. I'll email anyone the tour dates.
Well, I hope everybody here...
No, they're all online.
Everybody here goes to see it. So do any of you have any questions for Ian? There's one. How do the questions work? We got mics on the room.
Thanks, Ian and Charlie. That was great. My question is to Ian. Who have you got to play the part of Spike? And how mad are they?
couldn't see who was talking.
We've cast a very brilliant actor called Ian Hislop. In the original production, it was an actor called John Dalgleish, who was a wonderful West End actor. And in the tour, it's not entirely sure at the moment. It's between two of them. Again, the people playing the parts are not doing karaoke. I mean, they're playing them as characters, as real people. And I think it's quite a gift of a part, Spike. So you get to do Manic, you get to do most of the jokes, and you get to explain yourself. Watch this space, is what I would say.
Ian's been very diplomatic. I was talking to him earlier about this. And the guy that was meant to do the tour, who was in the original production, got offered a Netflix series. And much as he was committed and devoted to the theatre and touring theatre, it comes down to money again, as everything else does. There's a question. Is there one lined up here? You have to sing now.
I was just going to say, Ian, you worked with Peter Cook as well, who also had that famous thing with Dudley Moore being more successful than him.
Yeah,
did you notice any parallels? I think Spike Milligan was quite happy at the end of his life, where I'm not sure that Peter Cook was.
No, I mean, and that is quite right. That's an almost exact parallel. Peter Cook got very, very cross when Dudley Moore went to Hollywood and became a sex symbol, or what Peter called a sex thimble. But again, they did make up shortly before Dudley died. There was a sense that they were a bit like a marriage, in that they both knew they'd never been as funny as they were with each other. And again, people find that annoying in double acts. It's quite difficult. Dudley Moore was actually a rather good actor, Peter Cook, as he was the first to admit, only played himself. And I don't know if you remember, Peter Cook was once given a chat show, and he had to interview other people, and he managed three episodes, and then he gave it up. And I remember saying to him, why did you give it up? He said, well, I've got to talk to other people. So there's a certain amount of egotism involved in these performers. But Charlie's right, it was the lure of the States was just huge. People thought, if I can make a film and if I can go to the States, if I can make it in America, then I'm a proper star, rather than just... But again, I think people always underestimate that. You know, the vast legacy of you know, the radio shows and the books, I think will be much greater. You know, even the Pink Panther films, people start looking at them and you think, really? Oh, dear. You know, things don't last. Man in a hat.
The joke you told about pulling off my boots
made
me think that only works on radio. Do you want to say something about the difference between comedy for radio, comedy for TV, whether now in the visual age we don't appreciate, is it harder to write for radio? Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Oh, that's good. I thought you were saying that only works on radio, not on stage. I think it's slightly purer radio. You have to describe the world. And Spike always thought the radio was fantastic because you could never afford the set for any Spike scenario. I remember there's an episode where there's a man driving a Wurlitzer across the Sahara. Now, he's playing it, and sort of to realise that live is almost impossible and impossibly expensive. And the joy of radio is that the pictures are in everyone's head. And you have to put in more jokes. I mean, it's got to be tighter. And you can't get away with slapstick. I suppose hitting people with a sock full of custard is slapstick. I'll take that back. You can't get away with just too obviously visual material, which covers a lot of ground. But I think it's sort of, it's the primacy of the script for Spike and the sort of the primacy of that joke. He describes this in one of his books. He was very influenced by his father, who was a very strange man who was in the British Army, but he was Irish. And he did music hall. He did an act with Spike's mother called Loitering Around the Sentry Box. The two of them, can you imagine? You know, this was to entertain the troops in similar and unbelievable. But the other thing he said later in life, his father and mother, one of their hobbies was dressing up in cowboy outfits. They were very, very keen on cowboy outfits. And Spike describes a scene of his father coming up coming out, drawing pistols from these fake pistols, and saying to Spike, "This town ain't big enough for the two of us." And Spike saying, "What, Catford?"
We're just going over here. Have you got one there? Someone was... Oh, come down here then. Who wants to... We've probably got time for maybe one more after this, so put your hands up now. We can get the microphones in place. There's one being pointed at. Follow the pointing. I'll leave it to you.
I just remembered one thing. Sorry. I found this out very recently. It's not in the play. It's whatever. It was just Spike's attempts to annoy Peter Sellers back. Peter Sellers was driving... He'd got a new car, Spike thought, every month, because he was richer and he was flasher and he'd got a new car. And Sellers was driving along in the car and there was a terrible knocking noise. And he thought, "I've bought a new car. It's useless already." And he opened the boot and Spike was in the boot. Knocking.
You mentioned the Q series. Was Q genius or was it quite bad?
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I thought it was another question.
Supplementary question.
If I'd have been told, "Well, watch the Q series, here's a genius at work," I would have probably thought, "I don't really get this." It was the Goon's light and turned into telly. I mean, you know, it had its moments, but I don't think it matters particularly. It wasn't that great.
It was a quick answer back there.
Do you think his pre-war persona was always destined for comedy genius, or was it the war years and his PTSD that essentially made Spike?
I think the latter. I think he was a funny guy, and if you read the memoirs, he says joining the army was the best thing that happened to me. He got to play in a jazz band. He said someone once asked him, because he was in training for a year on the South Coast, and he was asked, "What did you do in training for the first year?" And he said, "I slept with officers' wives," which I think was a compulsory activity then. I think he grew up, he found that jazz was something he could do, he could entertain people, and... he was sort of waiting to find out what to do with all this confidence and this talent. And then he saw active service. He got hit. He was funny all in the lead up to it and afterwards. And then he hit London at exactly the time where there was a group of people. A lot of things in comedies are about a gang of people, other people who are there, a sort of impetus, a moment. And I think they... That's what we were trying to create, is that moment where it suddenly went like that. And everyone thought, we've never heard anything like this. This is just extraordinary.
So that's your prescription for being a comedy genius, is get yourself blown up.
Get yourself some talented friends, that
yes.
helps.
Well, talking of which, I mean, I first got to know Ian when I was making... and talking about, you know, people coming together at the right time and comedy teams, when I was making the Harry Enfield show with Paul Whitehouse. And Harry knew Ian before we did, and he said, Ian and Nick, Ian's writing partner, you've written the play with Nick as well, presumably. So I was going to say, you know, you've managed to keep your double act together for a long time, your writing partnership.
Yes, well, Nick Newman and I have written for most of our lives. I mean, we were at school together. And so we've kept... a partnership going for about 40 years. Mm. My wife refers to Nick as the wife, because I see more of him than her. Though now, obviously, she's happier with that.
And then I remember Harry, you know, because we were always looking for people to write, and Harry saying, "Oh, Ian and Nick have written something for us." And I thought, oh, God. But it was Tim Nice But Dim. Which Ian and Nick created and wrote pretty much all of. One of the best characters that Harry did.
Oh, thank you.
So I've always been very grateful for that.
Harry said to me, he said, "All my characters shout, and a lot of them are working class. Have you got anything else?" And I said, "Well, there's this character that Nick and I were at school with, who was, you know, because it was the 80s, and all public school boys at the time were portrayed as sharp as hell in the city making money, tough. And all the ones I knew were lovely but quite dim. And they were selling water filters for their father's company and just sort of not making it. But delightful and whatever you said, they would go, I would say, oh, Charlie Higson, bloody nice bloke. Bloody nice bloke. Probably never having met him. So we did this character for you guys, and actually, and I think it is true, on those productions, the more people you have involved, the more fun it is, or certainly was for us at that stage.
And you know, it was a great time. There were a lot of good, clever, funny people around. But the same tensions and within groups, because Harry sacked me quite soon after, so.
But then you went and did The Fast Year, which was pretty good revenge.
It was. We've made up since.
Yeah. So everyone gets mellow.
Yes. I look back nostalgically on it all.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm having lunch today with Piers Morgan.
And on that note,
no, I'm not.
Big hand for Ian Eastlip.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.